and welcome to the Science Podcast for April 25th, 2008. I'm Robert Frederick. This week, how mice smell sex, recognize siblings, and tell social order, future directions for plant genomics, and a radical treatment for diabetes through gastric bypass surgery. All this, plus our usual roundup of stories from our free online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the Science Society, publishers of Science Magazine, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. The American Association for the Advancement of Science at www.aaas.org.
Mice can smell the sex, recognize siblings, and know the social and reproductive status of other mice from the complex chemical signals, or pheromones, found in their urine. In this week's Science, Ron Yu and colleagues report how the vomeronasal organ detects and processes these pheromone signals as combinations of firing neurons. The work suggests that the responses to cues of male or female gender are based not on how the neurons fire, but on how the signals are processed in the brain. I spoke with Yu from his office at the Stowers Institute for Medical Research in Kansas City, Missouri.
So what we have found in this study is how social information of recognizing individuals and the sex genetic background of an individual is encoded by the sensory neuron. So what we are dealing with is a sensory organ called a vomeronasal organ. And what we found is the information about sex is conveyed by a very small population of cells that detect a very specific set of cues that are hormonally regulated. Information about individual, litter-mate, strain, and genetic background, so on and so forth, are encoded by a large population of cells, and these neurons appears to use the combinatorial activation of these cells to convey this information.
What do you mean by combinations?
The combination will be that each individual animal will have a distinct pheromone expressed. It's like a smell, or in human beings, for example, if you wear a distinct set of clothes, and that people will associate that with this individual. But those are not completely constant, as opposed to what encode the cues about sex. So one animal will have a different set of cues from a common pool, and that distinguish each from each other. That's why I think the animals from the same litter are more alike, and the animals from different litters are more unlike each other.
So it's not only the combination of the pheromones that the mice produce, but their ability to detect that as well. The combinations of neurons are activated?
No, the detection should be common. It's the cues that are expressed by the animals that are different. And there are genetic components as well. So littermates express similar cues, and non-littermates express dissimilar cues compared to the littermates. The detection side, what we found is that it's more objective. So it does not bias towards one set of cues or the other. It's the cues that are expressed by the animals that are different.
Okay, so it's not as if it's activating different cells then based on which pheromones or which sets of complex chemical signals that you might put on the cells.
Right.
Okay, so how first then did you test how the signals are conveyed from mouse to mouse?
We tested by looking at the responses of individual neurons. So we developed a transgenic animal that expressed a calcium sensor. So when neurons are excited in the vomeronasal organ, these neurons have an increase in calcium level. When you increase the calcium level, the calcium sensor will shine brighter, increases fluorescence. So we basically take the vomeronasal organ and cut into a slice so we can look at that under the microscope and record the signals. And by applying pheromone stimuli from different individuals of different sex and different strain, then we can see the pattern of activation in these cells.
Were cells exclusively activated for single traits like gender, or were there combinations of traits?
So the cells are for gender, we found a very small population of cells that are gender specific. And for other information, such as individual and strain, this genetic background information, our studies show that these are encoded by a large population of cells, and the cues are shared among individuals. So each individual will have a signature combination of these cues. So a specialist for the sex and generalist for the individual information.
How did researchers know before that these pheromones were being detected? Was it through this sort of chemical analysis or was it by behavioral observation?
It's mostly by behavior. It is mostly by behavior analysis. And little is known at the sensory level. And people don't really know the chemical nature of the pheromones. And it's not well understood what kind of signals mean transmitted. So this study suggests that the information about sex should be carried by a very few molecules that activate a very specific set of neurons. And this will give the opportunity to further identify these cues as well.
Were all cells present, all neuron receptor cells present in both male and female, so that both males and females could distinguish males from females, or were they tagged only to their own particular opposite gender?
Yeah, so we looked at both male and female animals' response to the same set of the pheromone stimuli, and we did not find any significant difference between the two genders. So that suggests the detection of gender-specific information or individual-specific information is not sexually dimorphic. Of course, there's the question of how does the animal, the male versus female animal, respond differently to the same pheromones. And we believe that is processed in the central nervous system beyond the sensory detection. And I think this study opens up an opportunity to further dissect the genetic circuitry, brain circuitry, that underlying sensory processing or social cues.
Okay. Well, Ron Yu, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Ron Yu is senior author of a paper on how gender and individual information is encoded by the mouse vomeronasal organ. Read the paper in this week's Science. This week's Science contains a special section on plant genomics. Online, you'll also find a special multimedia presentation on genomic complexities, insights, genetically modified crops, and the future directions of plant genomics. As part of that effort, we spoke with a number of scientists at the 50th Annual Maize Genetics Conference held recently here in Washington, D.C. Here's Science News writer Elsa Youngstead with more.
What scientists are learning about plants is like what scientists are learning in every discipline.
I think we still need to learn a lot more.
Jorge Nieto Sotelo specializes in maize and yeast genetics at Universidad Nacional Autónoma de México. The recent development of genetic maps has made his work easier because, he says, genetic maps are like any other maps.
To have a good map makes your life much easier. It's not like it's impossible to do it without a good map, but I think it makes your life much easier. It's the basics. It makes things faster, go faster.
But like so many scientists, Nieto Sotelo finds that getting answers faster raises questions faster. In his case, the genetic map for yeast helped him identify the protein he wanted to study in maize, one that made the plants less likely to survive high temperature stress, but also led to another more obvious change.
In maize, we observed that in addition to the high temperature phenotype of this mutant, the plants were taller. The mutant was taller than the wild-type plant. So there is an obvious growth phenotype in the action of this protein.
Karen Cohn says that finding a mutant, or making one, is key to understanding plant genomes. Cohn is a biologist at the University of Missouri, Columbia.
We try to infer the world, how the world works, by screwing it up. You make a mutant, you try and understand what's going on in the mutant, and then from that, you try to infer what must be normal.
While making a mutant has become easier through technology, inferring what's normal has become harder because there's more information to make sense of. For example, even if the genes of two individuals are identical, Cohn says how those genes get expressed, the epigenetics, can differ a lot.
I think what's becoming clearer now is that the process of actually turning a gene on through transcription is likely to be intimately connected with the kinds of epigenetic modifications that we see in DNA or the proteins associated with DNA.
But for now, Jose Gutierrez Marcos says that solving epigenetic puzzles will require a deep understanding of the sequence data scientists are only now gathering. Marcos is at the University of Warwick in the United Kingdom and studies the genetic and epigenetic regulation of early seed development.
50 years ago, we were looking through the microscopes and we were looking at chromosomes. Genomes provide us a platform to look at DNA sequence. I think the future will be looking at higher levels of complexity, like epigenetic information, and then network signaling between different components of genomes, So until we reach that level, I think that sequence information is pivotal.
And that sequence information is already useful. Marcos says the draft sequence of the maize genome, released this past February, will help developing countries.
I think developing countries have great issues with drought, environmental change, adaptation. So I think having a draft of the genome that is public will allow breeders in their own countries to develop their own programs, breeding programs. And I think up to now, this kind of information has been somehow locked in private corporations.
But private corporations are unlocking their data now too, particularly in maize. When scientists unveiled the publicly funded maize genome, the company Syngenta also unlocked some of its data. Here's Syngenta's John Arbuckle.
New discoveries help everybody. So, yeah, we hope it helps the public research community, and we certainly intend to benefit from that. So everybody, I think, will benefit from use of the material and the information.
Scientists and plant breeders can use that material and information not only to advance their understanding, but also to make new plant varieties through traditional and transgenic breeding programs. But as Torbert Rochford points out, traditional breeding is not what it used to be.
Today, traditional breeding involves using molecular markers, and so it's genomics-enhanced breeding. And so what we're doing is genomics-enhanced breeding.
Rochford is at the University of Illinois and works on getting more nutrition into plants.
And so the more information we have, the more we can understand the control. And so the more we know about the genes for performance, for disease resistance and insect resistance, and it's like we need to keep those genes and move the higher nutrition genes in without getting rid of those. Information helps us to get it into the growers' fields.
But getting growers to actually plant those genomics-enhanced or genetically modified seeds is another matter, especially for growers outside of the United States, where biotech crops are often looked upon unfavorably. Larry Beach is a biotechnology advisor for the United States Agency for International Development.
We don't have a campaign for trying to do that, per se, in terms of public campaigning, as much as trying to help get accurate science-based regulatory systems in place so that the countries can have good, accurate ways of doing their own regulations, how they see that they want to do them. We try to distribute information that's accurate that then can be available to people, but it's not a big campaign that we do.
But sending information, even if it's genetic information, is cheap. Again, Torbert Rochford from the University of Illinois.
From a developing world standpoint, we can just send primers over the internet, and they can synthesize them and select. And so it's electronic breeding. And that's the big if. It's a big if, yeah.
Wait, what's the if?
The if is developing the infrastructure and the laboratories to be able to do relatively simple molecular marker work and selection to be able to do this allele-specific selection. The information is there, but we're not talking about supercomputers and, you know, very, very expensive pieces of equipment. We're talking about relatively inexpensive pieces of lab work and some moderately expensive pieces of equipment.
But what's expensive is so often relative, especially when each bit of currency that could be spent on future research may already be being spent on food. For the Science Podcast, I'm Elsa Youngstead.
Science newswriter Elsa Youngstead with an introduction to the plant genome special section in this week's issue. Read more in this week's Science and see an online interactive feature at www.sciencemag.org/plant-genomes. Type 2 diabetes is the most common form of diabetes, a life-threatening disease afflicting millions of people. Various treatments are available to manage the condition, but there is no known cure. In this week's Science News, writer Jennifer Cousin reports on a radical potential treatment, gastric bypass surgery. As Cousin notes, the surgery does seem to reverse diabetes, but it carries its own risks as well.
The story's about gastric bypass surgery, which is a weight loss surgery that's been around for a while. And in the last several years, doctors have become more and more aware that people going into the surgery who have diabetes often come out of it not having diabetes anymore. And initially, that wasn't seen as all that strange, since they're also losing a lot of weight. And so their diabetes, and this is type 2 diabetes, would get better. But this seems to happen before they lose all this weight. So the thinking is that there is something going on that is independent of weight loss that's having an effect on diabetes. And even more recently than that, we've been seeing a much more concerning effect, which is extremely low, life-threatening low blood sugar, mainly in people who go into the surgery without diabetes. So it's almost as though it's reversing diabetes in people who don't actually have that disease. And that's a much rarer effect, but it is worrying people.
So the gastric bypass surgery has this impact on the person's insulin production or what?
That's something there we don't really understand. And like a lot of surgeries, this one developed without much research. Surgeons just went in and started doing it and trying their own different approaches. And now we're really going back into animals and doing more systematic studies to understand what's going on. But in general, the thinking is that what's done in the surgery is having an impact on hormones in the gut, and your stomach and your intestines secrete a whole lot of different hormones. This surgery rearranges your intestines, essentially, and there is a hypothesis that that has an effect on hormone secretion, and that in turn could affect insulin or other elements behind diabetes.
So what exactly is bypassed in this gastric bypass surgery?
Well, there are a couple different ways of going about this, but in general, the surgery does two main things. The first is that it seals off a large portion of the stomach, about 95% of the stomach, and creates a little pouch in the top part of the stomach that becomes the patient's new stomach, essentially. And then what it also does is skips over the upper part of the small intestine, the part that is attached to the stomach, and pulls up the bottom part of the small intestine, or a part slightly lower down, and reconnects it to this new small stomach. So you're skipping over a large portion of the stomach and then a few feet of small intestine that come right after the stomach. And that's the bypass.
I got to think that's got to be kind of important to how the body processes food. Is that what is essentially reversing diabetes? Is something having to do with hormones there?
Well, we're not completely sure. The small intestine is so long that skipping over a few feet doesn't appear to have a big effect on nutrition. People are still absorbing nutrients. It may have a small effect, but nothing really major. But yes, it does seem to have an effect on appetite. And there have been some studies looking at an appetite-stimulating hormone called ghrelin that's secreted mainly by the stomach. And that secretion does seem to change in people who have the surgery, so they are less hungry. And then we're just starting to look at some of the hormones that are secreted by the small intestine that may have an effect on insulin production.
So by reducing the size of the stomach and bypassing part of the small intestine, it seems that it's reducing people's appetite because of some hormone. But researchers still aren't really sure why this is reversing the effects of type 2 diabetes?
Yes, that's right. And initially the thinking was when people started doing the surgery, which was kind of in the late 70s, 80s, early 80s, they would notice that in some people right after the surgery, I mean, literally while they were still in the hospital, they no longer needed insulin. And the thinking was, well, they're not really eating when they're in the hospital. And that's really when you need insulin. When you eat, your glucose levels go up and you need insulin to bring them back to a normal level or a healthy level. So the thinking was, well, maybe there's something going on and it's an appetite issue. And it's true that the appetite does change after the surgery, even once they get out of the hospital and start eating more normally. But that doesn't seem to be enough. It can't explain the whole effect. And some people do think that this is mainly an appetite effect, but more and more people are thinking, no, that, you know, appetite's important, but there is something else that's going on. And that's why they're looking at hormones in the gut. Another thing that people have been doing is in patients who come up with this very severe low blood sugar and they're very sick, the treatment of last resort for those people is to actually take out part of the pancreas, sometimes even all of the pancreas, to try and reverse those symptoms. And for those people, we've been able to actually look at the pancreas that's been taken out to see if anything has changed. And right now, that's very controversial. But there are some researchers who think that, yes, the pancreas has changed. These people have more cells making insulin than you would normally expect to see, or the cells that make insulin are bigger than one would expect. But then there are other people who think, well, no, you know, we've looked at those pancreases too. We think that what's actually more important is that they look very much like the pancreases of people who are obese, and those people produce more insulin because they have more tissue that needs to get insulin. And in these patients who are losing a lot of weight, they're continuing to produce the same amount of insulin, but they're continuing to produce the same amount of insulin, so they have an insulin overload. So in a sense, that's sort of less mysterious than something going on with gut hormones that then changes the pancreas. But these are a couple different hypotheses out there.
It sounds like there are a lot of potential risks in having these surgeries anyway. Is the medical community advising this as a possible treatment for type 2 diabetes?
I would say yes, there are definitely risks to the surgery. It has gotten a lot safer in recent years, and it also seems to be safer at centers that do a very high volume of these surgeries. And there are a lot of people getting this surgery, roughly 130,000 in the United States last year, although the numbers are a bit hazy. And that's the most common form of gastric bypass, which is called Roux-en-Y gastric bypass. There are some other forms as well. But yes, there are risks associated with the surgery. The death rate seems to range from about 0.1% to maybe about 2%, depending on where the surgery is done. People can develop gallstones, hernias, infections. In some cases, they might need further surgery. This is certainly the minority of patients, but absolutely, it has its risks. It's not for everyone. And right now, it's really only advised for people who are quite obese or who are pretty obese and also have type 2 diabetes or other very serious conditions that are associated with obesity. So at the moment, most doctors are not advising this as a surgery for people with type 2 diabetes and certainly for people who are not obese and have type 2 diabetes. But there are some surgeons, particularly outside the U.S. and Europe, who are starting to perform the surgery on people who are less obese, though often still overweight and have type 2 diabetes. And that's certainly controversial right now.
So how long before the research community really figures this out? What's going on with all these hormones, the bypass of the small intestine, the increase of cells producing insulin in the pancreas? How long before we have an answer?
Well, I would say a lot of these studies are really new, and only in the last couple of years that people have started really trying to understand the mechanisms of the surgery and what it is actually doing physiologically. But there is certainly a push to start running clinical trials to compare this as a treatment for diabetes against the standard medical treatment for diabetes and see how people do. There was a study that was published last year showing that this did reduce the death rate substantially from diabetes in people who had the surgery. But a lot of the studies that have been done so far are pretty anecdotal. They're just reports of a single surgeon or a group of surgeons. They're not really rigorous clinical trials. And there's a push now to do that to try and determine whether this treatment makes sense and who it makes the most sense for.
Any numbers you can tell me right now?
There was a paper that was published last summer that concluded that the surgery did reduce deaths from diabetes by 92%. So that's substantial. And it's really a question of balancing what the benefits of the surgery are here against the risks. And both of those right now are somewhat unknown, particularly in people who are less obese.
Well, Jennifer Cousin, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Science news writer Jennifer Cousin reports on a radical treatment for diabetes. You can read her article in this week's Science. Finally today, David Grimm, editor of Science's free online daily news site, Science Now, joins us to talk about the latest science stories. Hi, David.
Hey, Rob.
So what stories do you have for us today?
Well, Rob, we'll talk about why when female butterflies change their color, they don't have sex on their minds, why not all captive tigers are mutts, and finally, how depriving bacteria of sleep can help fight infections.
Okay, so we got to start with females that don't have sex on their minds. What's going on with butterflies?
Well, Rob, have you ever noticed that in some species, the male looks very different from the female? Take mallard ducks, for example.
With the bright green head.
Right. They've got these bright green heads, and the females have sort of a dull brown head. So there's a very clear way to distinguish the male from the female. And that happens in a lot of species. And biologists have long said that the reason for this is because the males sport these bright colors because they want to stand out in order to attract females. And this was actually a theory that Darwin proposed, which was called sexual selection. But a contemporary of his named Alfred Russel Wallace had a different idea. He thought that sometimes it wasn't that the males were getting brighter colored. It was that the females were actually becoming more dull in color.
So it's not just sexual selection, but something else?
Well, Wallace's idea was that sometimes females become duller because they're at higher risk of predation. They have to carry eggs around and maybe they're nesting. And so whereas a male can just sort of get up and fly away, the female might be more constrained. So it's to her advantage sometimes to look duller or in some cases to mimic, say in the case of butterflies, a toxic butterfly, which may have different coloring, but would prevent her from, say, being eaten by a bird that would want to avoid eating something toxic.
An interesting hypothesis.
There hasn't been a whole lot of scientific proof for it. So a group of researchers studied about 200 species of swallowtail butterflies. And some of these butterflies, some of the species, the male looks exactly like the female. Some, they look very different from each other. And some of the species mimic toxic butterflies. And they mapped a variety of traits from these species onto a sort of a butterfly family tree. And what they found was that most of the species they looked at, indeed, the males and the females looked very similar. But in the species where the males look different from the females seemed to be mimicking a toxic species. And in one case, there was a male that had very bright yellow coloring. And it looked like from the family tree that the female also used to have very bright yellow coloring. But recently, well, in evolutionary terms recently, the female had mimicked a toxic butterfly that had much darker coloring. And so Darwin, say, looking at these two butterflies, would say, well, clearly the male's brighter because he's thinking about sex and wants to attract the female. But what actually appears to be happening is that they both used to be bright, and it's actually the female that's changed color. She's become duller to avoid being eaten.
So kind of getting beyond the male-centered view of evolutionary change.
Exactly, realizing that females can change too.
Well, from colorful butterflies to striped tigers. I've never seen a tiger not have its stripes. Is that what you mean by mutt?
Well, Rob, what we're actually talking about here is genetic differences between tigers that don't necessarily manifest in the way a tiger looks, but is important for a tiger being purebred or being a mutt. And we like to think that tigers in the wild are purebred. A tiger you would find in one specific part of the world would have a very specific genetic signature that would be different from a tiger you would find in another part of the world. And the reason these tigers have different genetic signatures is because they're adapted to the environments in which they live. But when we're talking about captive tigers, tigers that live in zoos or are owned by private owners.
Or are in the circus.
Or are in the circus, exactly. These tigers are often viewed as mutts. You know, nobody really knows where they came from originally, and they've probably been mated with other tigers, say at a zoo, that may have come from a different location. And so they're viewed as having very mixed genetic ancestry.
Why is that a concern if they're captive?
Well, the problem has to do with conservation. The number of wild tigers has declined dramatically over the last century. There's only about 3,000 estimated left in the entire world, down from about 100,000 where they were before. Meanwhile, the number of captive tigers have really shot up, and there was about estimated between somewhere between 15,000 and 20,000 captive tigers. So conservationists thinking about how do we save the tiger have gone, well, can we use these captive tigers to boost wild populations? But then we get into this mutt problem where people have said, well, you can't use these tigers because their genetics are all mixed up.
And so they're not adapted to the environment that you might release them into.
Right. They're not adapted to a specific environment. So they're pretty much useless in terms of conservation. But a group of researchers wanted to find out if that was really the case. So they sampled 20 years' worth of DNA from about 100 captive tigers from around the world. And surprisingly, what they found was that half of the tigers they looked at were very purebred. They had a very specific genetic profile that fit one of the five tiger subspecies. And that was really good news. Now, as a caveat, they say that a lot of the tigers they looked at were part of managed breeding programs, meaning that they were a bit more controlled in terms of who they mated with. And so they feel that if they really did a total sampling of all the captive tigers out there, the number of purebreds would probably be around somewhere between 14 and 23%, which is still really good news because that means that there is still a significant percentage of captive tigers that could theoretically be reintroduced into the wild.
But is that really the best strategy for conservation?
Well, a lot of experts think so. They're calling this a major step forward. But others say that the strategy might not work because tigers are very territorial, so it might be very hard to introduce captive tigers into the wild. And so instead, they say conservationists should focus more on protecting wild tigers and restoring their habitat rather than reintroducing captive tigers into the wild.
Well, from keeping the population of tigers genetically healthy to keeping all of us healthy by depriving bacteria of sleep, what's going on in this story?
Well, Rob, this story is about the idea that when we use antibiotics, say penicillin, something like it, to treat an infection, these antibiotics only kill bacteria in our body that are rapidly growing and dividing.
Why is that? Because they're taking in the antibiotic as if it were food?
Basically. But what happens sometimes in the body is that the bacteria live in a place where there's no nutrients present. And if that happens, they enter what's called a stationary state, where they just sort of hang out. They're not growing and dividing anymore. And if they stay in this state too long, they can actually become dormant. And if this happens, it doesn't matter how many antibiotics you pump into somebody, the bacteria aren't going to be affected. And maybe months or even years later, these bacteria wake up and they restart the infection again, which has been a real problem for diseases like tuberculosis, which have proven to be very hard to treat with antibiotics. So researchers were trying to figure out, is there a way of keeping these bacteria awake so that they can still be targeted with antibiotics?
So that's what you mean by sleep depriving them? You want to keep them awake?
Exactly. And so what this team did was they took a culture of bacteria that was in this stationary state where they really weren't doing much of anything, and they fed them nutrients. And as they expected, when the nutrients were present, that bacteria essentially woke up and started dividing and growing as they expected. But what was interesting was that there was a small fraction of these bacteria only stayed awake for about 1.5 hours. And even when the nutrients were still present, after an hour and a half, they sort of went back to sleep and eventually became dormant.
So the nutrients not only kept them awake, but also woke them up from the dormant state.
In this culture, what we're just talking about are stationary bacteria, not the ones that have become dormant and can persist for years. But it's just when they're at this stage where they're just hanging out and they're sort of, you could say maybe they're sort of snoozing, but they haven't completely gone into a deep sleep. And what's important about what the researchers found is that to prevent some of these bacteria from eventually entering this dormant state where antibiotics aren't going to touch them, you really have to hit them with antibiotics during that first hour and a half where you've woken them up. Otherwise, they are going to go into that deep sleep and you're not going to be able to hit them with antibiotics anymore.
So you wake them up with nutrients and also hit them with the antibiotics at the same time.
Right. The implication would be if you have a patient that has a stationary population of bacteria, you would hit them with nutrients, but you'd have to hit them with the antibiotics at the same time. If you waited too long to hit them with the antibiotics, then some of these bacteria are going to become dormant and become a problem later on.
What do other researchers think about this strategy for treating infections?
Well, some of them think it's promising and could have implications for treating disease. But others say that the bacteria in the culture don't really replicate what's happening in the body and that bacteria can become dormant right away. In other words, you don't really have this 1.5 hour window to hit them with antibiotics. There's always going to be some bacteria that have sort of gone into a deep sleep that you're not going to be able to touch. So it's going to take some further research to figure out exactly how promising this new strategy is.
Okay. Well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into for Science Now?
Well, Rob, we're looking into a story about what's going on in the center of very active, supermassive black holes, how our brain is hardwired for hierarchy, and finally, how a mother's diet can influence the sex of her baby. So be sure to check out the site.
David Grimm is the editor of Science Now, the free online daily news site from Science. You can check out the latest science stories at sciencenow.sciencemag.org. And that wraps up the April 25th, 2008 Science Podcast. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine and of AAAS, the Science Society. The content is provided by the news and editorial staff of Science, and Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, thanks for joining us.